Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Your Ben Jarofsky Show for this Friday, April 19th, starts now. On today's show, Ben talks Bulls, books, and more for Oh What a Week with Block Club's own Rachel Hinton. The Ben Jarofsky Show, a presentation of the Chicago Reader. ChicagoReader.com for everything there is to know in the city of Chicago. You want to know what to do, where to go, what to eat, what to drink. I said all that. The important thing this week is you got to get those tickets for the Best of Chicago at the Lincoln Park Zoo before they're gone. It's like five, six days left. You got to get them at ChicagoReader.com. And if you want more Ben Jarofsky, he's right there too at the ChicagoReader.com/Jarofsky. I'll spell it for you. It's J-O-R-A, V as in victory, S-K-Y.
Hello again, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. We're calling this Don't Do It Mayor Friday, and here's why. Actually, it's Oh What a Week, Rachel Hinton from Block Club is joining me. We're going to talk about some of her latest scoops for Block Club, which bring together a lot of issues we've been talking about on the show previously, and then we're also going to launch our book club. Yes, the Ben Rachel Book Club, or the Rachel Ben Book Club. You get to say whatever way you want it. Our first book is James by Percival Everett. Guests are I love my guests. They come on, they put up with me. They don't get paid, although a lot of them get a breakfast set or early morning delight. they've learned that. One of the many perks of the Ben Jarofsky Show. But then they have homework assignments, you know, and I'm sending them articles to read. They have to read and can I gotta read this, Ben? Well, Rachel got a whole book, okay? I'm holding up the book. I truly believe Percival Everett is one of the great writers in America right now, great novelist in America right now. I've been raving about him for quite a while. James is absolutely brilliant, revolutionary book and novel. And Rachel Hinton, I guess, is a Percival Everett fan too. And she said, yeah, I'll read it and I'll come on and we'll talk about it. So we'll get into that. But before we do any of that, don't do it, Mayor. And so I'm giving some advice to Mayor Brandon Johnson, which Mayor Brandon Johnson is free to ignore. As I always say when I give advice, any politician that takes advice from me is a fool. So I always say something like that. I'm paraphrasing Lincoln and what he said about lawyers who represent themselves. This has to do with something I've never seen anything like this. I mean, I've been around Chicago a long time. So there was this notion that went out that in the universe, Nader Isser wrote about this for the Chicago Sun-Times, excellent school reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, about how the Board of Education, appointed by Mayor Johnson, was considering closing magnet schools, limited selective enrollment high schools as well. And Mayor Johnson quickly said, no, that's not true. And Nader Issa actually wrote about how it's not true. And I forget where it came from, the notion where it came from. There was a bill passed in the House yesterday. I think it was yesterday in Springfield, which would overwhelmingly vote to prevent the mayor of Chicago from closing selective enrollment high schools. I've never seen anything like it. If listeners, longtime listeners out there can recall something like that, please let me know, where the House of Representatives in Springfield, just imagine Madigan doing this, voted to limit what a mayor could do with the public schools of Chicago in terms of curriculum or any policy. I can't imagine it. I cannot imagine under Mayor Daley. It was just the opposite under Mayor Daley. In 1995, they passed a law that gave him complete control over the Chicago public schools. The notion that Michael Joseph Madigan, as House Speaker, would then allow a bill to pass that would limit what Daley could do. It's just, no. And it wouldn't happen for Rahm either. So it's just like there's something's going on in the universe right now in terms of the mayor of the city of Chicago not having the power, not being viewed in the same way, I could, as another way of phrasing it, by the rest of the political universe. Definitely not having the power. There's not the fear of the mayor. Just, I mean, the vote was, I'm looking at this, was it 92-8 or something like that? It was just an overwhelming vote. I suddenly can't find the vote, but it was an overwhelming vote. And why I'm saying don't do it, Mayor Johnson, you have so many issues that you're dealing with right now. There would be such an outcry in the city of Chicago from parents of kids who go to these limited, or I call them limited enrollment, selective enrollment, high schools they have to test into. I could give a whole history of how these selective enrollment schools sort of evolved into what they are now from what they were back when I first moved to Chicago. I will spare you that recitation, that history. But the reality is that so many parents feel so strongly about these schools and are so happy when their children get into these schools. And when you mess with the schools, like when you mess with a parent who loves where his kid goes to school, they become active parents. And I know this because I lived through this moment. I'm ancient now, but there was a time when I too, Rachel Hinton, just think about this. I too was a young parent with kids in public schools. And like with losing my mind with all, some of the harebrained schemes of then Paul Vallis and Jerry Chico and Mayor Daley that they come up with. Like, who came up with this idea? This is the dumbest thing. And then we'd gather together in the cafeteria while picking kids up, and all the crews of parents would be assailing suddenly like experts on the school code and the law. Like, it's their kids. Like, it's just basic. I just can remember several rebellions in the 90s against some of the heavy-handed tactics of Vallis, Daley, and Chico. And Daley always was really kind of, he was kind of slick about it. Vallis would like implement the policies that would be controversial, having to do with busing. I can remember that one where he started limiting busing. And then Daley would be the guy to come in and correct it. Beautiful way it worked. Like, Vallis would cause the problem. Parents would lose their freaking minds and go to meetings, scream and yell at the board. And then Daley would come in at the last minute and order Vallis to change it. And Daley would be the hero. And parents would be like, love you, Mayor Daley. And they would just vote for him and one election after another. So my advice to you, Mayor Johnson, is just to, I know there's all kinds of ideological reasons. I understand. I could have a whole conversation about it. But if you don't, this is one fight you do not need at this particular moment. That's my advice to you, Mayor Brandon Johnson, which you are free to ignore, which I'm sure you will. With that, I will welcome Rachel Hinton to the show. Welcome back, Rachel.
Thanks for having me.
Rachel Hinton, extraordinary reporter for Black Club. Before that, BGA. Before that, the Chicago Sun-Times. I could go probably back further if I really tried, Rachel, but I'm not. I'm exhausted from just having read that part of your resume. Before we get to James and Percival Ebert, which we like the dessert, let's eat the main course. First of all, before I go and ask you about some of the stories you've written on, do you have any thoughts on what I just said about mayors messing with schools? Do you have any personal recollections about that? Mayors messing with schools and the turmoil it can cause?
You mean besides Mayor Lori Lightfoot's like fight with CTU and whatnot?
Yes, there's that. Yeah.
As you're saying that, I just had like, you know, like a PTSD memory of, you know, the union, the strike that happened. I think really what struck me is your point about picking your battles. It seems like there's so many things going on right now. I mean, the DNC is coming. There's this, the battle that happened this week with what, the bond program, or like the change in that. You know, CTA, what's going to happen with Dorval Carter? What's going to happen with CTA just generally? There are so many things going on that I, you know, also would ask the question, is this really where you want to spend your energy? Is this really where you want to spend your political clout or muscle, or, you know, just time? It just, this isn't, there's so many parents. Parents are, I'm not a parent, but thinking about my mom was very involved, kind of similar to what you just described. And I don't know that this seems like the best use of that energy. I think some of the other matters, like specifically around affordable housing, which was a big thing that, you know, the mayor campaigned on, I think that's really important. And I think this will, I think, figure itself out. But I don't know that I would spend a bunch of energy on it. If I were the mayor, and of course, you know.
Yeah. And Mayor Johnson, of course, Rachel is not the mayor, and you're free to ignore her advice. But here you got two people giving you the same piece of advice. All right. So I think you should just follow. Let this one quietly. But it is interesting. Rachel, I must point out, it's like there's a fearlessness to Mayor Johnson that didn't exist for Daley and Rahm. Hmm. And this is a blatantly infringing on Board of Education policy, you know, saying you can't close these schools. And it may be the best thing that could happen for Brandon Johnson, I think about it, is like he could tell some of his supporters who want him to get rid of selective enrollment schools and spend the money on neighborhood schools, say, I would do it, but I can't. They're keeping me from doing it. So I guess in some ways, I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, you could say it works for him. But I can't recall. Am I forgetting something? Maybe you can help me here a little bit. Are there any other matters that you can recall where the General Assembly, either the House or the Senate, completely infringed on something so specific as to funding high schools?
No, not that I can think of. I mean, I think the big infringement, so to speak, that I do remember is the bill to create an elected school board, really going over what Mayor Lightfoot wanted and really infringing on or ignoring her desires, requests, whatever you want to say. But I don't remember anything about like funding, I guess, for high schools. And that's not because like, I just don't remember that in my time covering the General Assembly.
Yeah. All right. Let's get to you mentioned housing. Let's start with housing and then we can get over to policing. And you wrote a story. I can't remember when it ran. It was sometime this week about the aldermen and women of Chicago City Council demanding that CHA CEO Tracy Scott appear before the housing committee, Byron Sixto Lopez's housing committee, and answer questions about the city's scatter site properties. I'm reading this from your lead. 500 of the CHA scatter site properties are empty, while more than 200,000 people are on the agency's waiting lists. And when I read your article, it just struck me as sort of an absurdity of life, political life in Chicago. And follow me on this riff, Rachel, and then take it away. It's like everybody agrees that we have a need for housing in Chicago. And the initiative proposed by the mayor, Bring Chicago Home, failed, which would essentially put a one-time tax on the sale of a property, on the most expensive property in the city, and then use that money to build affordable housing. So that failed. And in the aftermath of that failing, some of the real estate interests who were the lead of seeing it fail, fighting it, said they realize we have a problem in terms of homelessness in the city, and they were now going to put their brains on it. I'm waiting for that proposal to emerge. So it seems like across the board, everybody agrees we have a housing crisis in the city of Chicago. We need to deal with the issue of affordable housing. And here we have this DHA And you and Mick Dumke, my dear friend Mick, have been writing one article after another for Black Club about all the vacant property that the CHA controls, the Chicago Housing Authority, which oversees massive amounts of federal dollars. It's dedicated to creating affordable housing. That's its mission. And it's just sitting on vacant land, vacant units, big pots of money. And it's like you got to twist their arm to get them to show up to the city council and talk about the vacant units, the money, and what they're doing to address affordable housing. It strikes me as utterly absurd. Love to get you to take a little deep dive on this, talk about this issue in a little more specificity and sort of the political theater of it all. So let's just talk about the specificity of what you and Mick and other reporters have been reporting. Go ahead.
Yeah, so last year we did a story with Illinois Answers Project about the scattered site program that found, I want to say, 1 in 6 units within that program, which was created to desegregate the CHA's housing stock. 1 in 6 of those units is empty, is vacant. And the ones that are filled, and even, you know, the vacant ones are deteriorating. People are experiencing leaks or mold or issues with plumbing. And so after that story came out, several alder people, including Gil Villegas in the 36th and Byron Sixto Lopez in the 25th, I want to say, they said, we really need answers. We've been asking for CHA CEO Tracy Scott to come quarterly. I think she only appeared once last year, and at that meeting, you know, faced a barrage of questions, which makes sense. But we need more answers, and we need to like kind of increase the oversight on this agency. And so this week, actually, on Wednesday, the city council passed an ordinance calling for Scott to come before the Committee on Housing and Real Estate. A spokesman said, you know, she'll plan to show up in May, which is when this next meeting is supposed to be, to answer questions, to hear resident concerns. Sixto Lopez said, you know, along with resident concerns and trying to answer questions about these vacancies, they really want to understand the plan of the CHA to address both of those things and to kind of right itself, it seems. But yeah, I mean, like the political theater of it, I think it kind of mirrors what's going on with the CTA in that you have, you know, an executive of an agency who seems to want to fly low, even though the work that they're doing is something that many Chicagoans really rely on and depend on for their livelihood. And in both instances, there's been a real call for and a real push for, and in some ways, in both of those instances, it's actually happened, more oversight. Like, what's going on here? Why is the agency the way that it is? And really posing those questions to the CEOs. But I think, like, on top of that, you know, the political theater is like everybody wants to keep their job. Nobody wants to, you know, be made to look like a fool or whatever, especially in front of a city council committee or in front of residents or whatever. So I think trying to figure out how they're going to position her to, you know, come out looking smarter, looking on top of things, or make sure the CHA looks good or looks like it does have a plan, I think will be what we see in May. We saw a little bit of that. Sorry to kind of ramble on, but we saw a little bit of that in after our story came out last year. You know, the CHA announced this plan called Restore Home Initiative to rehabilitate, restore, potentially sell off some of these homes. I think 176 of the like 500 or so properties that are vacant. But, you know, time will tell like what happens with those homes. It's already been a long time for some of them. And like the conditions are already pretty bad. But I think by May, if they can have some sort of like, look at what we're doing, like this is how many units we have filled, or this is how many people we have like connected to housing since that story came out, I think that'll be really important for them.
I think your comparison to the CTA is right on target. There's a disconnect because I don't go back to housing, but it exists with the CTA as well. Because this is the entity that is supposed to deal with the problem that we're currently facing, and that, but it's almost as though alienated from it. They don't even exist. So they haven't been proactive about it, if you follow what I'm saying. Like, they haven't been a member. They haven't been at the table discussing what to do at all up till now. They didn't weigh in, as far as I know, on bringing Chicago home in any way. I don't recall anyone from the CHA advocating to pass it. Or be against it. They were not called to testify, as far as I know, for the city council about the housing crisis in Chicago when the city council was discussing whether to put it on the ballot. I don't understand the political dynamic here. Maybe you can help me with it. How we can have an entity dedicated to housing not being at the table when we discuss housing? And the same question, Rachel, can be asked about the CTA as well. I mean, that's a bigger, that's another problem, but let's deal with the housing one. So is it just a matter of this CHA exist only to pay the salaries of the people who work for the CHA? Help me out here with this.
I think it goes back to that wanting to fly low. I think it goes back to people not wanting that oversight or that like watchful eye of what they're doing, because then they have to be held accountable, or they expect accountability, which they should. And I think in both instances, it's hard to actually provide the services that you say you want to provide. I don't know, making sure all the trains run on time. Like, yeah, that's pretty difficult. Making sure that like everybody on these waiting lists has housing. Like, yeah, that's pretty difficult, especially when you haven't kept up with like building affordable housing, not just you specifically, but a city or like municipality or whatever. But I think that wanting to fly low and wanting to avoid questions and accountability ultimately bites people in the butt. Like, where are you? What are you doing? You have to answer for these things as the head of an agency that is tasked with doing that job. And if there are problems with affordable housing, or if there are problems with, we need more, train conductors or whatever, you have to be the one to say that rather than like hiding. Because when you're not saying that, then people are allowed to like kind of run with their own ideas or conspiracies, and like everybody puts on the tinfoil hat, and that doesn't help you, at the end of the day. Especially when like, let's say in both cases, like these people are like really actively doing their jobs and really trying to address all the problems that people like me, people like my colleagues at Block Club and other news outlets have been identifying. If you're not talking about that, and if you're not appearing before these committees or in the public to address questions, then people don't really know what's going on. And that allows for them to think that you're not doing anything, especially when looking at the things that they do know, it doesn't really seem like you're helping to address problems that they're bringing up.
And how much control, as far as you can tell, does the mayor have over the CHA?
So the CHA is technically or like formally an independent body. I'm not certain. I don't think that the mayor appoints somebody to that board. They have their own independent little government body. Their board meets, I want to say, like once a month. That's what I.
Well, yes, he definitely has the bully pulpit. And I got to tell you, there was a column by Natalie Moore in today's Sun Times, or Jeff Bernard Reed, before we move on to discussion of the police, about a new documentary on WTTW PBS, A Shame of Chicago, Shame of the Nation, looks back at the city racing housing history. And much of that, as her essay points out, as Natalie Moore essays points out, much of that documentary deals with the policies of the CHA back in the day, back in the late 40s and in the early 50s, in terms of building the scattered site housing that you were just alluding to in the first place, and then moving away from scattered site housing because of resistance by white people to having black people in their neighborhoods, and then bending to the political realities of Chicago and then Mayor Richard J. Daley. And so it, like, the CHA was a very active player in housing policies in the 50s in sort of a negative way. And this is what this documentary and Natalie point out. And now they're kind of like, they don't exist. It's so twisted and weird. They got to pass an ordinance or a resolution demanding that the head of the CHA in the old days, Mayor Daley would call up Elizabeth Wood, who was the head of the CHA back then, show up at this hearing, let the alderman yell at you for a little while. You know, that's what they usually generally do. They yell it. Very bizarre, very twisted. And the CTA analogy is spot on, where they have to demand Norvell Carter come up, you know what I mean? Drop in. And then they ask him about how many times he's taken the bus or how many times he's taken the train. You know how that's the political theater of it.
Yeah.
And then he makes a point of riding the train to the city hall that day. It's like, well, I just took it to very strange city we live in.
I do just want to say, correct that the mayor does appoint the board members, and I want to say the head of the CEO of the CHA. And they have terms kind of similar to the CTA board, but CTA has, I want to say, fewer members who are appointed by the mayor, or like it's a mix between like mayor and governor. So I just don't want to like, you know,
confuse people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, my favorite mayor before he became mayor was on the CHA board, and that would be Rahm Emanuel. And he was appointed by Mayor Daley. All right, let's move on to your article about police. And this one. See, we had a conversation yesterday with Peter Cunningham, where I always say it's like the eat the vegetable moment on the Ben Jarofsky show, where we take a deep dive into policy. And I'm like, oh, nobody's listening to this because nobody cares about policy. But the whole issue of what a police department is supposed to do. Crime is, again, we just talked about how housing is supposed to be a big crisis issue in the city of Chicago. And here we have the Chicago Housing Authority doing nothing about it. So crime is a major issue, obviously, in the city of Chicago as well. And so you would think there would be an ongoing discussion and debate as to what's the role that the Chicago Police Department should best play. What should our police be doing to maximize their talents, if you will, so they're most effectively acting as a deterrent to crime? I would like to have that conversation and discussion. And yet, not only do we not have that discussion, Rachel, but there's evidence that what the police department is doing does not really maximize their strengths in terms of deterring crime. And this gets at the heart of what you revealed with this report, with this article that you wrote the other day about 9/11 calls. So why don't you just summarize what your story had to say? Go ahead.
Yeah, so the report was on alternative policing, like methods or approaches, like around the country. Researchers looked at, I want to say, over 4 million 911 calls from 2022. Chicago was one of those cities. Generally, or like across the board, big picture, only 4% of those 911 calls were for things that the FBI classifies as like violent offenses, or like reports of gunshots. More than 36% of those calls were focused on low level or health related incidents like traffic issues, parking issues, car accidents, mental or physical health like issues or needs. Noise complaints like loud music, barking dogs, fireworks, etc. And then in Chicago, like to whittle it down a little bit more, they looked at 1.2 million calls, and a little over 26% were for like interpersonal violence or conflict, like domestic disturbances or violence, battery, assault, shots fired. 19% were for, you know, those noise complaints that I mentioned before, or abandoned cars, or burglary, or breaking and entering, or security concerns. But really, the researchers were saying, like, these things, you know, these topics that we see within these calls aren't things that the police officers necessarily need to respond to or need to respond to on their own, like especially for mental health needs or physical needs or something of that sort. Maybe it would be good to have like a mental health professional team up, which is something that we've seen happen, or focusing on like violence interruption, like programs to like help youth, like potentially not be gang involved, or like, you know, after school programs and things of that sort. So really the researchers were, they gathered these calls to be like, look, like if we take some of the money we're putting toward policing, or, you know, in our budgets across these like 8 cities that we looked at, if we put them toward other programs, what could potentially happen? One city that they looked at, or that they held up as like a success story, I want to say it was Richmond, California. I didn't include that in the story just because, like, population wise, it's pretty different, but they ended up really gearing their budget toward alternative policing strategies. So like those, some of those programs I just mentioned, and they saw like a reduction in their homicide rate, I want to say in 2023. So for them, it's been successful. I think there were a couple of questions about like, what does this look like on a massive scale? And they were saying like, we think that this could be successful more generally, but I don't know if they had the data at the time to back that up.
And what's the sort of the political dropout in Chicago, political backdrop, I should say, in the city of Chicago? Is there a desire to implement the kinds of changes that Richmond implemented? Is there a desire to even have hearings about the matter? Or is it too what? Controversial, because it seems too passive in terms of aggressively dealing with crime?
Well, like the city has a couple of programs like that already. Like they have like sobering centers, or like they're in the process of like creating a center where people who are currently intoxicated or who are maybe like on drugs or something of that sort can go and be connected to resources and connected to like professionals who can help as they begin detox. There's also like another like violence intervention program. But I would say more generally, I didn't hear anything, surprise, surprise, maybe, on whether or not there would be hearings on this. We reached out to the mayor's office, and I don't think that we got a response, or not, don't think we didn't get a response. One of the people I spoke to in the story said that she spoke to the mayor before he became mayor, and she expressed some optimism about potentially implementing like alternate response models, but without, you know, kind of a plan or a comment on like where things stand now. It's a little hard to say.
Wow. Didn't get a response from the mayor's office. Boy, oh boy. Is that, does that sound for, but just give them some response. Mayor Johnson, since you're listening to this show and taking tips and advice from me, or ignoring it, just have someone call back. Okay. Just, oh my God. That's just, wow. I don't really know in our current climate if we could have a calm, a rational discussion, Rachel, about this. And so, for instance, we talk on the show, we've been talking a lot about the Dexter Reed case, and there's many different elements of that case that you can explore. That's, of course, the shooting by police officers of a 29-year-old man. Who was pulled over. Not quite clear exactly why he was pulled over. It was in March, March 20th, I want to say, or 21st, around there. So just follow me, folks. That's about a month ago. He was pulled over, police got out of the car with their guns drawn, and he ended up, the video shows he fired first, and then they shot him, killed him. What's that? What did you say?
Shot him over like 90 times.
Bullets were just blasting away. Guns were blasting away. So there's many different issues that have to be explored. One is why did they pull him over in the first place? They said, well, he wasn't wearing a seatbelt, that it's not clear. How could they tell he wasn't wearing a seatbelt? Because you had tinted glass. And is this how you deal with someone who's not wearing a seatbelt anyway? And then when you ask questions like this, there's immediate counterattack of, oh, what are you condoning shooting at police officers? And so it's really difficult to have a conversation, because then you're accused of being, you know, in favor of shooting at police officers. And it's very challenging, to put it mildly. So when the video is released, much of the criticism that I've read in the media, including an essay by Paul Vallis, in yesterday's Tribune attack Andrea Kirsten, who is the head of COPPA, released the video and then commented on the video. And they said, you can't comment on this because they haven't interviewed the police officers. Follow me in this, Rachel. And you cannot comment about an investigation until the investigation is completed, which is a repeat in many ways of what was said in the Laquan McDonald situation. And we only had a discussion of what went down with the Laquan McDonald situation when a Cook County judge forced the city to release that video. Rachel, we probably still be waiting. They'd still be investigating the Laquan McDonald video, the Laquan McDonald shooting from 2014 today, if that judge hadn't released that. And I'm like, why haven't the police officers been interviewed already? That was like, I was with Mick at the basketball game the other night. And we were like, why haven't they? We kept saying that to each other. Why haven't they interviewed? And it's just all part of what I don't know what else to call it, but the absurdity of that seems to be the word that comes to my mind of where we are. We talked about it with housing. We talked about it with briefly with public transportation. Now policing. It seems like we're not addressing any of the issues that are at stake. It's all political theater. That's my general riff on all this. Your thoughts?
I do agree with the political theater point of view and the fact that it's hard to have a nuanced conversation. It's like whenever you say anything, really, like no matter which side you're on, you're kind of vilified by the other side. And that makes it incredibly hard to have these conversations in a way that's like, that allows, I don't know, for nuance, basically. Like, and it makes it hard. And I think it makes us all kind of siloed and we're all kind of like sticking to our sides and like, okay, I know that these are safe people to talk to, or like safe meaning that like, I won't be called a bigot or like someone who doesn't back the blue or who does back the blue, so to speak. And that just makes it so much harder because I don't think that, you know, in politics or in policy, you can get things done in substantive ways by just sticking to your one side, or not all the time. I do think that with the shooting, I mean, I think that your point about like, we'd probably still be waiting for like Laquan McDonald, if the judge hadn't said like, you have to release this video, like it's crazy that you're not doing it. I do wonder if like the COPPA head, I don't remember exactly what she said, but I do wonder if maybe she should have held off. But also like on the other side of that, like have they just not interviewed these officers? Like this happened back in March. Like I thought that there was some rule that like after an incident, you have like a certain time frame to interview people, to interview the involved officers. But I'm not certain. I don't know. I think absurdity is a great way of putting it. It's just like, it's a lot of things that make you go, huh? Like we're still doing it this way? Or, and then also you can't really have like open discussions about it. I don't know. And I think everything that came out after, you know, this video was released, the fact that like traffic stops are higher in this area on the west side, the fact that this Mr. Reed, you know, he was shot before by police officers and had PTSD from it and was dealing with a lot of mental health concerns. I think it kind of goes back to what this report is talking about, that maybe if there were other policing models, if there were like, you know, maybe better or more involved or like more frequent CAPS meetings or something for police officers and community members to actually get together and talk to each other. If there were other ways to create and foster community and support for people, maybe we would see less of this. Like, I think that that's ultimately what the report is trying to say or what it's trying to get at. And I do wonder that, I mean, especially when looking at some of the details that have come out since the video was released.
Yeah. And you're right. And then, you're right. You immediately get, someone's going to call you a name on one side or the other. That is so true. So if I were to say, which I think is, I think most people would agree, if someone starts shooting a gun at me and I have a gun, I'm going to shoot back or I'm going to run away. Well, if I don't have a gun, I'm going to run away. So the notion of criticizing police for firing back at a man who's shooting at them, I think is, to put it mildly, unfair. This is me speaking. On the other hand, 96 shots? I'm sure they were fired after long after Dexter Reed had stopped firing. So like, what's going on with that? You know, that's a legitimate question as well. But if you ask that question, then you're anti-police. And if you point out that it's legitimate to defend yourself when someone's shooting at you, then you're pro-police brutality. So you're right. You can't win in this, and when it's just name calling. And then aggravating it, follow me on this. Kirsten went on the Stephen A. I don't know if you saw this particular element. She went on Stephen A. Smith's podcast. Stephen A. Smith generally talks sports, but he's now moving into politics. Actually pretty good, I think. Whatever, that's aside. She's being criticized by strong supporters of the police. I'm like, wait a minute. Are you telling me Johnny Catanzara, the head of the Fraternal Order of Police, can't go on Fox? You know, Alderman Raymond Lopez at the 54th can't go on Fox, you know, to talk about these things. This is kind of weird. You know what I'm saying? It's like political theater. I don't know if we're any closer to solving anything. Go ahead.
I don't think we're any closer. I think also, you know, going back to the, you know, no matter what side or what you say, you're going to be cast in some light. I want to say when officers were approaching the car, they didn't identify themselves, or maybe he didn't hear it or something like that. But yeah, if like a bunch of people are walking up to your car and someone's like jiggling the handle, like I would be freaked out by that. I don't know. Just thinking about like all of the different things that we now know about this and like the conversations that we're having now after it, it just makes it incredibly hard to figure out like, how are we going to solve this? My former colleagues at the Sun-Times did a story about like how the shooting casts doubt or brings up a bunch of questions about police reform efforts here. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, like, what do we do? Like, what do we learn from this? How do we, I want to say after each of these incidents, which is unfortunate that there are many incidents after which you have to think about like, what are solutions? What are things we can take away from this? Like what needs to be done differently to make this not happen again or to make it not so big. I don't know. And I don't know that anybody really has answers to that or answers that are going to like totally solve this issue.
All right. Well, we're not going to solve in today's show. So we'll move on to the next topic, which is the Rachel and Ben Book Club, which is having its inauguration with James by Percival Everett. I will now show the viewers who can't see it, James. I don't know why I did that. I just for the hell of it, which is sort of a sequel to this book, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain. Yeah, so I have both books. I'm showing Rachel. And if you view, if we, you, the viewer, could see it if you could see this, but you can't. So I don't know why. As you can see, Rachel, my James is in far better condition than my Huck Finn. This Huck Finn was a book I probably purchased when I, oh my God, copyright 1958. No, I didn't get it in 1958. As old as I was born then, but I was not old enough to read it. So I probably bought that. That's the college book. I've read Huckleberry Finn like five times in my life. And all right. So let me just start this by saying, anybody who's listening to this podcast knows I'm just a big time fan of Percival Everett, who is a very, an eclectic writer. I'll never know what he's going to do next. I'll never know the style that he will employ in his novel. He has written some of the most beautiful novels about, and short stories about the West, which read like something out of Steinbeck, where cowboys are riding through the mountains and they're dealing with the ravages of nature. All of a sudden there's a rainstorm or a blizzard and it's just a great adventure story. And then his book The Trees is like a zombie book that the premise is, follow me in this one, that black people who've been lynched come back to life or come back to Earth to seek revenge on the white people who lynched them. And one of the characters, the zombies, is Emmett Till. So just pause and think about that, ladies and gentlemen. And that book is actually a kind of a comic book, The Trees. There's two wisecracking detectives who are solving these crimes, these bizarre crimes, these cannibalistic crimes that they're uncovering. So it's like a wisecracking detective story. It's like he's mixing all these different genres up, and he just does it so effortlessly. And then he just abandons it for the next book, something completely different. So you all probably know, if you know him at all, from American Fiction, which was the movie American Fiction, which was created from a novel he wrote, gosh, I want to say 23 years ago, about being a black avant-garde writer, a novelist in the white publishing world that has no regard for what your art is and wants to turn you into something else. And it was made into a movie that was very popular. James, wow. James is kind of like American Fiction, you know, in some ways, because it's a satire that deals with novels. But it's really a revolutionary book that's totally is going to change the way Huckleberry Finn is perceived, the way it is taught, in my humble opinion, the way it is talked about. And in that regards, this James is probably his most significant, will have his greatest impact, in my humble opinion. So that's my opening about Percival Everett in general. Why don't you tell folks a little bit about what happens in James so that they, and you know what, ladies and gentlemen, we're not going to worry about giving stuff away too much, all right? So it's not like.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, so go ahead.
James, I would say, pretty closely follows Huck Finn and all the ins and outs, the quote unquote adventures that Huck Finn and Jim, the slave, face. It's got a lot of, they're just on a raft floating down the Mississippi. It's got the King and the Duke. But I think what made me really like this is that in the time periods of Huck Finn, when Huck and Jim get separated, it focuses on Jim. It focuses on what's going on for him. And I think even more importantly, like the struggle of being an enslaved person and knowing that it's not right and interacting with other slaves. And it allows, I mean, not just like character development for Jim/James, but also a real world building and a real, I don't know, insight, I guess, into slavery and into, or at least slavery through the eyes of Percival Everett, and like how society functions at that time. I think often when we read things about slavery or like even reading Huck Finn, it's a real like, slaves don't know any better, or slaves aren't smart, or they don't know what's going on. But no, James is immediately aware of like white people and his place in the world. And that, I mean, he has a line in here about, you know, the only people who get hurt by them thinking that they're inferior is us. And I really feel like that captures this book. I feel like he's very aware, and the slaves in this book are very aware, but also like, because of slavery and because of the evils around it, that awareness only causes pain and causes like, I don't know, distress. Mm.
So there's a big age difference between Rachel and myself. I have many years on her. So here's my question for you as representative of the younger generation. I sat through two classes dedicated to Huckleberry Finn, one in high school.
So sorry.
which was many years ago. There were still dinosaurs in Chicago when I went to high school. An outstanding scholar I was at Evanston High School back in the, and I remember in 1972, I think it was, they mm-hmm. were at Huckleberry Finn. And then in college, and two distinct types of conversations about him, one in college and one in high school. Did you ever study Huck Finn?
I did. When you were,
go ahead. Talk about that.
High school, my sophomore high school English class, honors English. That year was one of just like reading really white literature. So we read The Awakening by Kate Chopin. We read Huck Finn and we read The Great Gatsby. And I want to say we read like maybe a couple of poems or something like that, but it really felt like the teacher was trying to teach us about great literature. And I really felt at that time angry that in a way that now I have the words for, but at the time I was like, you want me to read Huck Finn and you're telling me this is a great American novel and that it's all about irony and satire and he's really, you know, vindicating the Southern, like, you know, ideology about slavery. But that's not, there was no room for debate or discussion around that. There was no room for, especially as a Black student, one of two or three, because I grew up in the suburbs, like a suburb near Naperville. There was no room for discussion around, this doesn't do it for me. This doesn't seem like a great novel. Like, I don't care about this. Or even to like engage with and debate, do I really feel like this is irony or satire? Or do I feel like this is just like any other book written at that time? And so I remember writing my paper on, I think we had to write about irony or something in Huck Finn and being like, all right, now that's done and I'm never going to do this. and then we moved on to Great Gatsby and like the Great Gatsby was, I mean, I really enjoyed it. But I think looking back on that time now, I was like, this is interesting. Like there's something missing here and it's all the writers of color. And I think when reading this book, I was like, oh, this is great. Like this is, there's so much depth to James and this adds depth also to Huck Finn. And I wish that if I was going to read Huck Finn again, that it had this in it or like coupled with it or something like that.
Wow. We could do a whole, show about this sophomore English class. I would love to do a whole show on this because there's so much follow-up I want to have. So how many kids, how many students were in this class besides you?
Roughly? I want to say it was like 25 plus, like maybe 25 to 28 students or something like that.
So you're one of about three Black students.
I want to say so.
In a class of 25 reading Huck Finn.
Yeah. And I remember just being like, what? Like, I was not into it.
Yeah.
And the discussions that we had were, you know, in part about the content, but also I would say about irony. It was a real focus on like, how is irony portrayed here? And it's like,
I gotta tell you something. To me, James, as like when I think about what James is dedicated to, one of all the different topics and issues that it themes it's dedicated to, irony is at the top of the list. Percival Everett is obsessed with the concept of irony. And he's constantly like, and James is a bit of a literary scholar. Here's the great thing about James, the character himself, and guy is a genius. So the facade he puts on, okay, so just so you know this, if there are any people out there who don't know this, in Huck Finn, there's a slave, runaway slave named Jim, who's constantly referred to with the N-word. So you should need to know that. So that Jim in Percival Everett's book is the protagonist, whose name is James, and he's brilliant. So he speaks in code. So to white people, he speaks as though he's illiterate. But then he's just like pontificating about the different forms of irony in the world. You know, like I'm running to a dictionary because I didn't even know. I'm like,
or he's talking about like Voltaire and Rousseau, and like it's like this is totally not what you would expect. This is not Jim, quote unquote. Wayne's Huck Finn. This is a completely different character with nuance and depth and stuff. So,
So he has these dreams or nightmares or whatever they are, where Voltaire comes to him and they have conversations in French, and Locke, John Locke, comes to him and they have conversations about philosophy. Yeah. This is the real, I'm putting it in quotes, the real Jim that you don't see. And so the irony that Everett is doing is that Mark Twain was completely unaware of the potential of this character that he turned into this like comic figure, you know, like this guy could be as smart as you, Mark Twain. He yeah. could have been, but you chose to make him like this comic character, a buffoon, if you will.
Yeah. I think even that kind of gets to irony, or like Percival Everett's irony, that, you know, Mark Twain uses Jim, quote unquote, as this buffoon, but kind of a heroic father figure, I guess, by the end. But really, like, isn't it ironic that you tried to use this character to make a case against slavery, but also kind of fell into this, like, your own guise? Like, you fell into the very thing that you were trying to, like,
yes,
like make fun of or point at, you know? That really made me like it more.
So let's go back to the 15-year-old Rachel Hinton. Let's take a trip down the Mississippi to the 15-year-old. That's metaphorically on the Mississippi. So as much as you can go back in time, it's a lot closer to you than me going back to the 15-year-old Benny Jarofsky. All right. But so it's a shorter trip for you to go. Can you recall what was going on in your mind? Like you're reading Huck Finn and you're seeing all these, the N-word all the time. And you're in a class with 20 or so white kids, in suburban Naperville. Do you know, do you remember what, were you like aware, in a very specific way of what the challenges were?
You know, racism at the time?
Yes, exactly.
I think less than I am now, but I think at the time there was a real, I mean, I've always had problems with authority, but I think that they really came out at that time of like, why should I trust that this is a great American novel? Like, you haven't made the case to me that this is a great American novel. And feeling like in our discussions in class, that wasn't really talked about. It was just like, okay, we're going to read some great literature, or like great literature of, I don't remember. I think that there was like a time period that we were focusing on or something. And I remember thinking like, of all the books that were probably written at this time, this is the one. Like, I remember just feeling like at first, like maybe it's me, maybe I just don't get this. And like reading like the Spark Notes and trying to figure out like, is there something I'm missing? But like, like I was like, but no, I think me now understands that like the James in this book is like what I wish had been presented to me at that time. This, I keep going, I hate saying the word nuance so often, but he's multi-layered, you know? And in the book, in Huck Finn, it was just about this, what, 10-year-old kid who's off on adventures, doesn't really face any repercussions or like the drama and like trials and tribulations of life at this time. And knowing that slavery was, I mean, just generally awful, but there's an enslaved man with you, and that he just kind of disappears into the background. He doesn't really exist except for character development. I think like me now says that, but I think at the time I was like, what am I supposed to take away from this? Like, why is this great? And I still ask that question, I think in part because I did not go back and reread Huck Finn before this conversation. Like maybe now I, you know, would get something else out of it. I don't know. I don't think so. All due respect to Mark Twain. But yeah, I was like, nah, this isn't for me. There's going to be something better.
By the way, more ironies abound. The Mark Twain Humor Prize was won this year by Kevin Hart. I don't know if you saw that. So I had a little fun. I wrote a column. I go, in future years, it'll be called the Percival Everett Prize because everybody will move away from Mark Twain. I doubt that it's ever going to happen. As you were riffing about your mind in when you were a sophomore, I was a junior when I read it, and I was totally clueless. And it was only when I read Percival Everett James, Rachel, I'm reading Percival Everett's James, and the character is pointing out how terrifying slavery is. This concept that you could be sold down the river, that you could be killed at any given moment, and it would be okay, legitimate. They could just kill you. That fear and the terror that is in a slave's mind, knowing that. And I'm really like, oh my God, that if the real Jim that Mark Twain was writing about would have been living with that fear. And only a cartoon character could be exempted from something so real as the terror and the anger being separated from his wife and his daughter.
But also his whole community, like that whole plantation, you know, all the, what's his name? Like Luke, I want to say.
Yeah.
His friends, like at any point in time, your life can just be completely ripped apart. And society doesn't view you as human, doesn't view you as a person with feelings, doesn't view you at all, really, you know, and like that's totally fine. You just have to deal with it. Like, that's totally missing from Huck Finn. Sorry to cut you off, but
no,
like,
no, it's absolutely true. And you know, one of my pet themes in this show, Rachel, is like how we're brainwashed. I was talking about how we're brainwashed. And I feel like we as young students at Evanston High School in the 1970s were taught about this book in which there is no consequence for slavery. Slavery is such an abstraction and not real in any way that we would be introduced to a slave who does not feel any fear, any terror. He's a comical figure. Yeah. And I feel like going far here, Rachel, so keep me in the planet. But when I look at MAGA denying history right now, which is a very strong, powerful movement in states like Florida, I'm like, you know what? That's not exactly new. In some levels, that's been going on my whole life. A denial of what history is in our country and promotion of great literature and great characters, which are fraudulent in my humble opinion. And it only, my eyes opened when I read, I took Percival Everett in 2024 to get me to realize, oh my God, this is utterly ridiculous that Jim in Huck Finn would be terrorized by slavery. I don't know, your thoughts.
Yeah, I feel like in my recollection of Huck Finn, it, like, how could you have a slave character who doesn't seem to have any understanding of the world that he's in and the world that he's navigating through, even with this like 10-year-old kid? Like, there doesn't, I don't remember, and I, you know, maybe there's stuff in there. Maybe there's some things about like Jim saying like, oh, like you're a child and like I'm an adult and like people are still going to find that weird. But James, again, is very aware of that. He's very aware of his place in the world and understanding that like someone's going to think this is weird. Like, you can say that you own me, but this is still going to create problems. Like, I think really James has a better understanding of the world that he's in, of the place that he's in, really, than the Huck Finn, Mark Twain character. I think, again, he's just kind of a prop, you know, there for kind of taunt, like, oh, like, look at how funny slaves can be, or like, look at how funny Black people are, or whatever. But again, missing the point of the full character that's there.
Yeah. And the ending is radically different as well. And I'm really torn between not wanting to give the ending away and wanting to ask you about the ending. And I don't know, maybe I shouldn't. I mean, there is a surprise that happens. Well, the Civil War happens at the end of James in a very, which is, we all, even no, I'm not even going to go there. Yeah, everybody knows about the Civil War. Although, again, there's a movement in this country to make it seem as though the Civil War wasn't about slavery. And James makes it very clear. Percival Everett makes it very clear in James that slavery was at the heart of the Civil War. But you know that surprise I'm talking about the relationship between James, the character, and Huck Finn, the character.
Yeah. Did you feel like that was a surprise? Because I feel like there were Easter eggs throughout. Also, I put a bunch of Post-its in my book. So.
Oh, yeah. No, there were. I see where. Look at. Ladies and gentlemen, you didn't see that, okay? she may not have read Huck Finn to prepare.
Not as thoroughly.
Too traumatic. I got to tell you, man, I reread chunks of Huck Finn after I read James, and it just didn't, I was like embarrassed. I'm like, oh my God, I'm seeing this book with new eyes, and I can't believe I ever liked this book. And
anyway, gotta burn it. Just kidding. Don't burn books. Don't burn books.
Don't burn books. She was just going, that was irony, ladies and gentlemen. Clinton was doing irony, right? Yes, but you're correct. There were little Easter eggs, as you call them, that led up to the quote unquote revelation. Should we share the revelation, Rachel? The ball's in your, I'll let you decide. I'll let my guests decide. Should we share the big revelation or just tell people there will be a big revelation? The decision is yours.
I want to talk about it. So like maybe if people don't want to hear what the revelation is, like skip this part or something. And they're going to understand.
Skip this part. And then when you're done reading James, come back to this part. Okay. Yeah. Go.
Yeah. I feel like that the revelation is that James is actually Huck Finn's dad. I feel like thinking back on the Easter eggs, I was like, what's about to happen? And I think that adds to like the irony aspect of this, that, I mean, especially the struggle between like being someone who wants freedom, especially James, because he can read and he can write. And like, I mean, he can do more in some cases than some of the white people during this time period, but he's enslaved all because of the color of his skin. And then seeing his son, you know, be a free person and also kind of like, I don't know if that's dramatic irony. I don't know what kind of irony that is, but it fit the kind of irony theme that we're going for here. I think part of me was like, not disappointed, but I was like, okay, like, I guess I can see that because he does really care about this kid. And I was also trying to think about it in reference to Huck Finn, like, why would Jim really kind of go out of his way to be with this kid and to make sure that he's okay and to take care of him? And I guess like the fatherly love, even though he's probably working through all of his feelings around that, I guess that makes sense. But I think part of me wanted there to be no connection between the two of them. Part of me wanted, like, I just wanted them to stand alone. And Huck learns that people suck and are untrustworthy in many ways, just as a white kid navigating the world, not because his dad is slaved, enslaved.
I appreciated the fact that Percival Everett took it there. And it just kind of, to me, is just indicative of how, like, this guy is so smart, Percival Everett, he's so brilliant, you know, that he would. So it's one more little twist, because in Huck Finn, Huck, who's the younger than Jim, treats Jim like Jim's a child, and they tease Jim and they torment. He and Tom Sawyer tease Jim and torment him, and they treat him like he's inferior. In James is the daddy, literally the daddy. And yeah. Huck, it's just such a twist on everything. And Percival Everett is saying, I'm gonna take this thing, this where I want it. But it also gets into this, which is another big theme in James. And get your thoughts about this. James has a lot of things going on in James, but one of the subtexts of James is the whole concept of passing. A black person who has light or white skin, yeah, passing for white in the white world at a time when there's slavery. It's so twisted and weird because Huck Finn is treated like a white person. And so he has all the freedoms that a white person has. And suddenly he realizes, oh my God, my father's black. That makes me black. And well, there's another character in the book who goes, is the same thing. And
yeah.
Your thoughts.
Very different outcomes too for that.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting and not something that I really thought about before reading this book. I read the book Passing by, I want to say, Nella Larsen. Really good. I think it was made into a movie that's on Netflix now. But yeah, I mean, just the terror that would come with, especially during this time period. Passing, the other book, is I think set in like the 20s or 30s or something like that. But yeah, I couldn't imagine like the terror of that, but also like what that says about like your place and how you move through society. Especially I tried to think about, I think the other character's name is Norman. Does that sound right? Yeah. And Huck Finn, and how in both instances, their ability to pass allows them better lives, but also, for Norman, I mean, it doesn't really do any, it doesn't make any difference. Like he still dies. He ultimately chooses to, not pass basically. He's like, I'm a slave. I'm going to go with Jim. That creates other problems. So I feel like it doesn't afford you the same kind of safety that maybe you think it does, especially if you're aware of it. Like, I think the awareness means that you can never truly be at peace because you're seeing how people are treating you. Basically, you're seeing how people are treating Black people. And I think it's really hard to cut that off, because even though you may be accepted, you know, on the surface, if people knew who you truly were, they wouldn't accept you.
Yeah. And then that, just that concept, that phrase, who you truly are, because it's really ultimately identity. And so your identity to a large point is shaped by how other people perceive you and then the expectations they have of you. And I just want to say this one time, you were saying that, James is smarter than most of the white people he meets in the book. James, the character Percival Everett creates, I cannot underscore this enough, is absolutely brilliant. Okay, he's smarter than 99.9%. He like shows the displays like come. This is the other. There's another Percival Everett book called Dr. No, which I don't know if you've read that one yet. Yeah. Where it's, oh my god, the protagonist in that book is a brilliant mathematician, and I don't know where Percival Everett learned mathematics the way he does. He full display. I was constantly looking stuff up. These theorems. Like, is this made up? No, there's really this theorem. I don't know how this Percival Everett. So James is aware of mathematical theorems from time to time. You know what I mean? So it's like, This guy is freaking brilliant. All right, we'll close with this. In your humble opinion, should future Rachel Hintons in the AP class in suburban Naperville, or out of the suburb of Naperville, wherever it was, and all of your classmates, if they're going to teach Huck Finn in the great American literature class that the smartest kids in Naperville take, should they also be teaching James by Percival Everett?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Obviously to me, this is much better. So like, who knows what like future kids think, but I think that teaching them together allows for like a better, more cohesive narrative. So it's not just focusing on Huck Finn and what happens to him when they get separated, but it also is truly about slavery and is truly about this time period in a way that I think Mark Twain's book does not fully get at and doesn't fully satirize or, you know, kind of poke at. I think that this book does a much better job of really making you question society and question society at that time. And also, like, I think really gives a better look at how terrible, horrific, like the constant anxiety of slavery, that anything could happen at any point in time, whether it's your fault, whether it's not, it doesn't matter because of the place that you're in life and in society where you've been put. I think that this, to me, I mean, obviously it's better to me than Huck Finn, but I think that the two go well together and I think would create really good discussions on it.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. And I don't know. Yeah, maybe you don't need to teach Huck Finn anymore, you know, and or unless it's used as a way to sort of understand James. How about that as a twist? So anyway, well, that is the first of what I hope will be many Rachel Benn book clubs. Now the issue is, what is to be read next? So let me just understand something about your reading habits. I don't fully understand. Are you most, like, you told me this before and I forgot. Are you mostly fiction or nonfiction?
Fiction.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, you're like me. I'm almost exclusively fiction. So I picked this one. So you get to pick the next one. All right. Fair is fair. Sure. So whatever you want to pick, I don't care what it is, you tell me. and I will dutifully read it. And if I've already read it, I will dutifully read it again.
Great.
Right? And so the ball is in your court for part two. And I also want to say there was talk of having Ramana Hussein join us for this, except I don't want to embarrass her or anything, but she hasn't done the assignment. Come on, Ramana. She hasn't done the assignment yet. So
we got to get her for the next one.
Yeah, we'll get her for the next one. Maybe she'll get the assignment for there.
I might read the short stories. The one that Half an Inch of Water, I think is what it's called.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are you reading that one now? By Percival?
No, it's on hold at the library. Shout out to the library.
Shout out to the library. That's the Western. That's the first thing I've read by him. It was Western. It was a story. And it'll blow your mind that the same guy wrote those stories, wrote James. Okay. Because it's like naturalism. It's cowboys dealing. But he is Percival Everett. His mind goes. So it's like some of the cowboys are black. That'll blow your mind right there and then, you know, I mean, because you just think if it's all white people out there in Wyoming or wherever. And
sure.
Percival Everett is a very unique guy. So, by the way, Percival Everett, if you're listening, and I know you're a big fan of this podcast, you ever want to come on and Rachel and I'll bring Rachel for that one. Definitely. We'll talk James, trees, you know, American fiction, half an inch of water, whatever you want to talk about Percival Everett. You could talk about police issues in the city of Chicago if you want. We'll be happy.
You should send him your column.
Yes.
I'm your number one fan.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I love you. Lord, I do love him a little too much. I don't actually do that. Man, I just like his writing. Okay, ladies and gentlemen. All right, Rachel, thank you very much for taking the time. It was a blast. It really was. Doing the book club. And we'll do another one just as soon as Rachel figures out what book I'm supposed to read. So have a great weekend, all right?
Yeah, you too.
All right, that's the great Rachel Hinson. I also want to thank producer Chris. He does an outstanding job. I think Rachel and Percival Everett will agree with me when I say, hey, producer Chris, give yourself a raise. Take it out of petty cash. Peace and love, everybody.
Have a great weekend, everyone. If you got time to kill, make sure you spend some time at ChicagoReader.com. There's not only Ben Jarofsky, there's a lot of other great reader writers that have a ton of Chicago info that's going to keep you entertained. It's going to keep you informed. It's all there. Check it out. And if you want to follow Ben on Instagram, it's at Benny J Show. Don't forget to tell your friends if they like the show. If you tell some Republican friends. Ben likes to have some listeners write him letters. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and follow The Ben Jarofsky Show on all your favorite streaming and podcasting platforms. Thanks so much.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.